Welcome to The Derivative by RCM Alternatives, where we dive into what makes alternative investments go, analyze the strategies of unique hedge fund managers, and chat with interesting guests from across the investment world. Hello there. We're back in action this week and wading into the oil patch with my Jackson Hole ski buddy, who just happens to also run an energy trading CTA. Yep, it's Brent Belote of Kaler Capital. And after the mandatory chit-chat about ski and snow conditions, we get into how his models look at energy markets, whether greenflation is real, what happens dozens of years from now in oil if and when we're fully electrified as an economy, and how it's been for him hanging his own shingle and running a small hedge fund. Send it. This episode is brought to you by RCM, from clearing to execution, portfolio construction to outsource fund ops, China to Nebraska. RCM has you covered for all things futures and derivatives. Learn more at rcmalts.com. And now back to the show. All right, everyone. We're here with Brent Belote. How are you, Brent?
Doing great.
Good. I had the pleasure of seeing Brent in person on the slope at Jackson Hole. Had his, what was she, two? Is that your daughter or your son? I can't remember.
Three, yeah, she's three.
Three on a little like leash. Leash is the wrong word, harness.
Yeah, she's on a harness and she was skiing down. She's already off it, so she's in the race. She's off to the races on the ski
yeah, before. She was good. And you had all three kids, one in red, one in green, one in blue. It was a tight program you're running there.
Yeah, you gotta keep them visible at all times, so it's good.
And then I was all ready for you to say, oh, you just missed it, the snow is terrible. Then it all came right after you left, but you said it's already terrible again.
It was great for about a week. We got about 4 feet of snow over the 10 days, and then the last 4 days it's been in low 40s with kind of rain and melting. So it's been a quick change in end of winter already.
And then we're recording this last week of Jan here. So you're going down to iConnections, go down to the warmth in Miami soon.
Yeah, excited. So I leave on Sunday down there for four nights. The conference just keeps getting bigger and I'm hopefully it's still as great as it was last year. So I'm looking forward to a busy schedule and hopefully we can get some institutions and looking forward to speaking on the RCM panel on Monday night at
that's right. We've had you on the pod a couple times before, once when oil went negative. That was fun. Talking through that seems like 1,000 years ago. When was that? Like May of 20?
April 20th, 2020. So that was the day it went negative. And I think we did this the day after. So it would have been the 21st.
Yeah. 4/20/20 was the day it went negative. And then we had you back on, talked through the strategy. So we'll link to that and people can go back there and hear all the ins and outs of what you're doing in the strategy. So I wanted to start and just talk through kind of how your thinking and strategy has changed over time. We've known you and been following you and had accounts with you. What now for how long has it been? 4 years, five years.
Yeah, we've been running for 5 years now. So
5 years. Yeah. So tell us, give us the, what's the same, what's different over those 5 years?
Most is the same in terms of strategy wise. And, what's changed is this last year in 23, yeah. We hired Sam Vogel to be our COO. So now it's not just myself, which is nice. We're building out a little bit more of a team and a bench. We'll likely look to add one more to the employment this year. And we've passed over $50 million in AUM with kind of pretty quickly. So right now we're at just under $55 million AUM and have been growing pretty steadily. So hopefully we can get close to 100 by the end of this year, if not sooner. So that's kind of the guys behind Miami is to go down there and hit fundraising pretty hard.
What do those people need to work in Jackson Hole or get to work in Jackson Hole, I should say?
They can remote? Work wherever they want. Sam's based out of Houston and he has two young kids. So his was kind of a non-starter for moving.
Yeah.
I think good people over location is priority. If they want to come to Jackson Hole, even better. So, but it's not a priority.
And that doesn't make a good podcast. I wanted to be like, well, I used to go massively short 600% nat gas and now I've scaled it back and we only do this or that.
Yes,
but, so the risk levels, everything's generally the same, the portfolio, how you look at it.
Yeah, everything's still been the same. We haven't changed any strategies over the last 5 years. We've launched a commingled vehicle on the Galaxy platform, so we do have kind of fund access, for lack of better words. I have noticed a change in the last, call it 2 years, in our investor base. We're seeing a lot more institutional fund of funds, and even kind of the multi-strats of the world have started looking at external allocation. So as we grow, I think that's kind of the next evolution of Kaler Capital, if you will.
Yeah, I think I've seen a little bit more of that too, of people looking and being more interested in discretionary and not even discretionary, but systematic and discretionary commodity traders.
Yeah.
So take us a step back. If it hasn't changed, then tell us how it's the same and give us
How's
the
the same? We're still.
30,000 foot view of, yeah, of what you're doing for people who don't want to go listen to the old
Yeah,
ones.
so we still run a systematic oil strategy. Our kind of two-prong approach is we look at what does the supply demand look like over the next 6 to 12 weeks for each oil product. And then we have a quant overlay that looks at the physical markets, looking at the various basis markets in each one. We run about 70% of our VaR in relative value and 30% directional. So we do have exposure to long short oil, which has been good of late. And it's something that a lot of people have kind of been gravitated towards because our correlation to oil is fairly, close to zero, just because we have the ability to get short and get long. When we do really well, I like to think of it as a event-driven systematic. We do very well when events happen in the oil market that kind of push the physical market to a brink. Obviously, COVID 2020 was a great year for us, and 22 of Russia Ukraine was another great year for us, kind of when the physical markets had to kind of react to satisfy some of the oil flows that were necessitated around the world.
And what do you attribute that to, that the fundamentals align with your technicals and
Yeah,
basically everything's rowing in the same
we
direction?
track over 1,000 different daily data points on the supply demand, and we're able to kind of see those or forecast them, I guess, fairly well. Like with COVID, we could see that we were filling oil storage globally. Demand hadn't caught up in terms of either bouncing back. And we could see that if we were kept filling up oil storage at this level, we would hit a point where we had to either cap it off or cut supply. And that's pretty much what happened when oil went negative, was they had to cap supply because oil storage was pretty much full at that point. And same with Russia, Ukraine. We saw oil flows still actually coming out of Russia at pretty good clips, and they were still getting on ships and finding a home. And we were able to see that, and they kind of call BS essentially on the $140 spike that we saw in oil. So we were long going into that, but we ended up exiting as a result of seeing those flows. The models caught a pretty good job of seeing that the physical market actually wasn't that tight.
And do you think of it more as like, hey, this is smarter access to oil prices, right? Of like, we should capture, if there's a big run up, we should capture some portion
Yeah.
of it,
Yeah. I mean,
but
that's one thing with oil that I think people get a little wary of is the geopolitical risk. But we've done a very good job of playing that over the last 5 years. We haven't had any down years in 5 years. And will you get caught off sides on certain days or certain weeks in relation to moves? Absolutely. But I don't think in the long run, we're catching the bigger moves for sure. And I think that a good example was, we had a drawdown in the last 6 months of last year. And we were pretty much max short going into the weekend when Israel Hamas situation exploded, and oil was up pretty big, and all the products were up pretty big against that, and kind of took us out of a lot of our short positions in that. And I think the next day on that Monday, I think we were down only about 80 basis points, but it we missed a huge decline in oil as a result of that. And that happens sometimes. Sometimes the physical markets take you out. And it changes kind of the landscape of oil for the next 3 to 6 months.
but do you feel like your investors would rather you be almost a long flat profile? Like if you miss the big down move, so be it. Like we really want you to capture more if there's an up move.
I would say so. I would
Yeah.
say, I mean, I think that's probably a fair assumption just from a standpoint of, if oil goes to 200, the S&P is going to take a hit. Your house is, there's going to be knock-on effects of $200, $300 oil if it gets there. And it's nice to have us as a kind of catalyst for that if we catch that on the way higher. So I would definitely agree with your comment.
Love it. And then, so over that 5 year period, what oil's basically flat, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy to say, but yeah, it's pretty close
I'm
to it.
just gonna pull it up real quick. Yeah, I guess here in Yeah, in late 18, it was right about 65.
Yep.
Now about 75. So what, we went.
Yeah, it's not too crazy, not too far off from that.
And what's that range when we were 65 to negative 20 to plus 140 back to 70?
Yeah, there's a lot of alpha
Woo.
and a lot of boost.
And you don't have gray hair yet. So good work. Good work. Yeah.
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. My
Yeah.
kids are still young.
So changing subjects a little bit, and we'll come back to what's going on in oil, but talk. So those 5 years, right? You came out of a bank, you were a trader, you said, hey, I want to go do
Yeah.
my own thing, hang my own shingle. For any young people or old people or whoever listening who were thinking of maybe starting their own fund or something, what was harder than you thought? What was easier than you thought? What lessons did you learn?
I think the lessons coming for me out of a bank was how to manage risk on a very micro level. You know, we have a huge balance sheet at a bank and you're able to trade a little bit differently. You know, we have VaR levels and we have set amounts, but I never thought of margin to equity or, you know, what's my annualized volatility look like or even drawdown for that matter. You know, I had a hard finite number of drawdown in my, you know, at JP Morgan, but say I was up $30 million on the year, my drawdown could have been, you know, 35 at that point and no one would care, right? Because they just care about the positive numbers on it. Whereas at Kaler Capital,
35%, you're saying?
what's that? No, 35 million. So like, you know, they just think of it in terms of dollar numbers.
So if you're up 30 million and you draw down 35 million, like, all right, this guy's fine. He's only down 5 million.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, so that's, you're able to kind of, you know, build a buffer that you're able to trade against.
Yeah.
Whereas with Kaler Capital, you know, we're constantly getting new accounts, you know, monthly, quarterly, et cetera. And each one is essentially starting at zero. So your drawdown, you know, if you have an account that started at you know, on, and you happen to be the high watermark, you know, like we, great example was last year. We were up, you know, 20% through the first 6 months of the year. We had a couple accounts come in and then we subsequently, you know, lost about 12. Now we still finished the year up on it, but those guys are kind of, you know, longer term investors, which is nice, and they believe in what we do and how we do it. But timing is kind of everything with it, which is why with us, you know, we run a higher volatility portfolio, and it's nice to have people who are in it for the longer term. You know, like we've made money every year, but we still have people that come in, will be in our program for 3 to 6 months, and then decide it's not for them and close, whether that's profitable or negative. It's different. So, you know, that was a big change was in terms of how I take risk and how I think about kind of the overall strategy.
Right. It wasn't just end this period with the as much money as you can.
Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly. You think of daily returns, daily, you know, daily VaR. You know, you can't have, you know, if you think about like a big option portfolio, you can't have a day where you're down 15%, even if the next day you're up 25, because just the amount of volatility that it's spitting off is not palatable for 99% of the investor base. What took longer and what I kind of underplayed was I thought having a 10-year background in a bank would allow me to either come out and be able to raise seed capital on day one. And that was far from the case.
Yeah.
Pretty much people view a bank like
They don't
a,
trust it. Yeah.
yeah, they think that we just have so much information, so much systems. And at the bank, we call it seat value, where, you know, each trading house has a, you know, each place you're sitting has a seat value. And that's something that you kind of have to get around that stigma. And so it really took me almost 2 or 3 years of track record before it happened. And then, you know, 2019 we came out and had a good year, but not a great year. 2020 was a good year. But then every call I'm having after that says, well, was this just a flash in the pan? Were you a
Yeah.
one-off? And so it really took 22 to validate that, hey, we're catching bull markets, we're catching bear markets. We've done this, and that's where I think like our next growth is coming. And now, you know, crossing 50 million, which you know, we have some investors that have taken that have capacity rights that will expire, and they said they're going to use them. And what that'll do is we're going to grow pretty substantially from there. So I think, you know, I think just getting to that critical mass standpoint is kind of where we're at.
And so almost the one thing leads into another there with the bank, right? Like I think people might not trust track record because they know that you didn't have the same risk profile and
For
it
sure.
was just about making money. It wasn't about the path of how you make that money.
And even then, I had a great call with you know, I would call it a multi-strat investor. And they said, you know, like we like you, we like what you do, we like your returns, we like how you're thinking about the markets, but we need to see that you can manage big money outside of a bank.
Yeah.
Now, whether I had, you know, $100 million years at JP Morgan or whatnot, they want to see that we can manage, Kaler Capital can manage 50, 100, 200 million to make it count. And they want to see that scalable. And it is an interesting thesis because it does change things when you're dealing with such large numbers. You know, like how do you mentally think about, how do you sleep at night knowing that if you have $300 million, if you have a 10% drawdown, you just lost $30 million, you know, and
Yeah.
numbers get big. And that's, you know, again, though, you know, we've one of the advices advice I got from one of my bosses back at JP Morgan was, if you're gonna lose early, because it teaches you, learn a lot about yourself in your career when you have these big losses or drawdowns. And I think it's really true of how you bounce back for them. How do you mentally handle being down? Are you second guessing yourself? Are you conviction? Like, what's your conviction rate? You know, so I think for us, being a systematic actually has really helped with that. It's helped me, you know, keeps us on a strict guidelines of risk tolerance, keeps us on the strict guidelines of how we think about the market and where it's going. So it's definitely something that keeps us on the railroad tracks for sure.
I was going to say, how do you handle that? But by being systematic. But right, in theory, in the math of it, the systematic part of it does. I'm doing 30 contracts. I'm doing 300 contracts.
Yeah.
It shouldn't matter, right?
Yeah. I mean, our program is scalable easily to five, 600 mil billion dollars. It's more a function of how much infrastructure do we want to build out and where do we want to go with it? You know, as you grow, you need more people. As you get to bring on larger LPs, they will request additional, whether it's chief risk officer, whether it's
Yeah.
a legal vehicle that we have to house ourselves. So there's a lot of kind of nuances to growing. And that's what we're trying to do right now is just grow smart. You know, we want to grow consistent. We want to grow, you know, during returns that are, we can show that we can make money during this time and lose money during this time, and that it's still the same program, whether it's 30 million, 50 million, 500 million. And so that's kind of where we're at right now.
So the harder part is you can't just blow through 30 million and everyone still goes out for a beer after work. What the easier part, there's got to be an easier part. What's the good part about going out on your own?
Oh, about going on my own?
Yeah.
I've always liked in trading that it's a very, you know, it's a meritocracy. It's if you make money, there's a scoreboard. And if you do the, you know, if you make money, you get paid on it. And that's something that I've always liked. And also it's heavily scalable. Like you mentioned, whether it's 30 contracts or 300, the process and the way I think about it in the business is all relatively similar. So just being able to kind of build a business and have something that we've done and kind of building a legacy of things that you know I've worked my whole life for, is something I really enjoy. So I really enjoyed kind of the entrepreneurial aspect of it, of building a business and finding different partnerships. And you know, we're kind of at a point now where it's been really fun. We're starting to, you know, look at different partnerships, and possibly it might make sense to create a joint venture with another fund, or it might make sense to launch a multi-strat, or you know, we're kind of hitting critical mass where we can start thinking about different avenues and different partnerships that are really exciting.
You missed the obvious answer, which is you get to live in a place like Jackson Hole.
Yeah, that is true. Well, that was
Yeah.
all. That was my main thing was when we, so back to the bank, we were living in, my wife and I were living in New York in 2016, and in February we found out we were pregnant with my first daughter, Kaler, and it was kind of a make or break where, okay, well, I'm from San Francisco, she's from LA, we both went to school in LA, we thought we were going to move back to LA. So it was, okay, well, what job can I get in LA? And there
Yeah.
wasn't a ton of finance, especially in commodities. You know, commodities is very, very
Yeah.
localized to, you know, New York, Chicago, Houston, and London. And it was kind of a situation where we either have to live in one of those three or four, or I could try to do this on my own and we could live in California. And as luck would have it, we got to California and turned around and came back to Wyoming. So it kind of worked out that way. But it was definitely something where I decided that I was going to give it 3 years to make it work. And if it didn't work, then I probably would have been back in either Houston, London, or New York.
And do you ever see if some pod shop or some energy group came calling and said, hey, we want to give you this huge check to come trade back inside the group and you can do it remote?
That there's a price for everything, and my My answer is always, I had an offer to go to Houston last year, but it would have been Houston to be part of a larger team. But the it's I want autonomy. I've ran my own company now for 5.5 years. I've built a good business,
Yeah,
and
that's a tough drug
if you
to
want me to
kick.
come there, like I'll come build a business, but I want to be my own pod, and I want to be able to bring and hire people and grow it. And I'm not leaving Wyoming.
Right.
So
Those are
those are
my
the
terms.
usually at that point they say like okay, let's keep in touch. So
What are your thoughts? I don't know how deep you are in that world, but on some of those pod shops in particular and energy, right? There's been a few energy groups that have trader in different electricity markets or different one oil trader, one gas trader. What are your thoughts on how those guys run a book and what they're doing?
I think what they do is great. I think it's, you know, it's kind of the it's just the multi-strat model, and you're seeing that more so. There's not a lot of, you know, 20 like $5 billion commodity funds these days, and the reason behind that is it just makes more sense to go to these pods and go to these shops. Now if we lived in Houston or we lived in New York, I don't think I probably would have ended up jumping to one of those, but the autonomy of Jackson really made it a non-starter for us. And I think that's why a lot of these pod shops are ones that are now looking at external capital. And I think it's because they realize that hiring a guy like me, who it's easier to almost and cheaper for them to just give Kaler capital money than to try to hire myself and my team away and give me the amount of capital that I would require and the amount of, you know, I would say the initial sign-on as well. They're like, well, we'd rather just give you money instead. So that's been where a lot of our interest in the last 6 to 9 months have come from, is some of these
Right, it's
guys that
more
I
of
didn't
a
even know have external capital capabilities are calling us up asking if you know, and we've had that.
lease your performance versus buy it outright.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when I say, like, you know, when they hear my request of I'm not leaving Wyoming,
Yeah.
and I want my own pod and autonomy, and then they go, so.
Yeah. And given there's all those guys and right there, what are they paying some of those guys to come out of those banks? Like millions?
It just depends. Like, it's interesting
Yeah.
because, you know, I talked to a lot of my friends about this, and especially that we're still on Wall Street, and they're not really paying them huge sign-on bonuses. They're just buying out their existing equity that they have. So the way like our bank pay was we would get 2/3 2-year deferred and then 1/3 3-year deferred. So if you have like 3 good years of JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, whatever, you're going to end up with a very large chunk of equity that's kind of rolling off over the next 2 to 3 years. So most of these would end up in a situation where you have to make them whole. They won't just walk away from that because it's just too much. So a lot of the large numbers you see when it says, you know, Millennium pays this guy $20 million, it's like, yeah, but
He had 18 coming to him or
yeah, he
whatever.
had 18 coming to him over 3 years at Goldman Sachs, so they at least had to make him whole. And in these the
But still,
numbers
they're
still
still
the
paying
numbers
it,
are
right? They're not
numbers
getting
are
it from
really
Goldman.
stacked. And what's interesting is I had a call, I won't name names, but I've had calls with those people before, and I've told them, I said, listen, we're growing fast, you know, like Kaler Capital's at 50. If we get to 200, you know, the number for me and to buy my team becomes exponential at that point. And their response was, we would rather spend 10 times as much money to buy someone who's running a 200 or $250 million fund than an emerging manager like yourself sub 100. And I found that fascinating, that they have so much money that they'd rather wait till you've made it than do things. So
They probably know what they're doing there. Like, it's
yeah.
not just
That
not
said,
worth the risk.
we have no plan to close Kaler Capital or return them
Yeah.
this money, and we're still fundraising. Life's good.
That's good. And then I think we've talked about it before and some other, but I'll just again for some of the younger people listeners out there, like how hard is it to get those seats, right? And to be successful in them at the banks, at these pod shops. I mean, one precludes the other, right? But
Yeah. I mean, really hard these days because,
yeah,
you know,
there's less of them.
what's that? There's less of them, and they're less risk oriented. Most of the banks these days think of their commodities traders as almost, they're more market makers. They want to satisfy their clients because they make way more money on the financing and hedging operations and investment banking than they do on the commodity side and actually trading around it. So there's still some very large risk takers out there. Obviously, the largest is VTOL. And what's funny is when I left JP Morgan, I was in a final round interview with Vitol in Houston, and one of my good friends was the other one, and he got hired. And now, like, we joke about it. We still talk a lot, like 5 years down the road. And I'm like, man, I can't imagine my life if I got that over you and you, you know, over Sith. And I'm like, I'm so thankful you were better qualified for this and did it just from a lifestyle perspective with Houston and time and kids and everything. So, you know, certain things kind of end up being a blessing in disguise, but those seats are very difficult. And
is it the right schools, the right connections?
I mean,
pacing the interview, all of the above.
I don't even know what JP Morgan is now, but when I started, you know, I got hired out of grad school and they were only hiring MBA interns from, I think it was like four. It was like NYU, Harvard, MIT, and I forget the other one. And then even their undergrad was even more stringent of like five or six. And I don't know where they've kind of gone from there. And they had a whole piece where 2 years after 2008, they made a rule where they'll only hire if you were an intern. So you have to intern and then you transition. So, you know, and that was when I came out, you know, and I did my internship, I interned on the natural gas desk, and my boss at the time, Nedim Soylemez, was like, listen, you know, I want to hire you, but I don't need you in a year. I need you to start now. He's like, I can't, like, you know, the typical, you know, MBA at that time was you go to 1 year, you go intern, you get hired, and then you kind of piss Finish. Off and screw yeah. around for your entire second year of MBA, knowing that you have a great job, you know.
Right.
And he was like, no, I need you now. So it kind of changed my second year MBA a little bit. But I wouldn't change anything. You know, I got such great exposure to different opportunities and you know,
and do you think whether you're in those seats or whether you're where you are now, like, is energy trading the hardest trading there is?
I don't know. I've never had much exposure to the other ones. I can't say that. I would say, you know, I would say no. I think there's probably other ones out there that carry more nuance and more, you know, but I think.
I'll rephrase, the most competitive there is, right? Because you have these huge shops, Vitol. Yeah. All the banks,
because
the
you
energy
have that
groups.
With other things, like if you're a rates
yeah.
trader, you
yeah,
know,
true.
Much, there's only so many. Like, what makes commodity trading a little bit more manageable is the amount of money needed to start it. We're a $50 million, you know, essentially oil fund, you know, oil program. How many $50 million credit funds do you find out there? How many $50 million, you know, rates? Like, you just don't have those outside of some of these large, you know, the blue crests that have $10, $15 billion of credit allocation. So it's a smaller sandbox when you get larger because you need more money for them. So it's I don't want to say it's the most difficult, but I would say it's probably one of the more accessible. And if I wasn't, I don't think I would have been able to go the CTA route.
Switch tacks again here. So let's talk about oil in general, energy sector in general. Kind of, we touched on a little bit that 5 year range has been basically flat, but a lot of volatility in there. So wherever you want to start, but do you want to start what we saw in 23, what kind of stood out to you the year gone by?
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me has been the knock on effects of Russia, Ukraine, even from 22, it created such a distillate, you know, shortage globally that it was something that we were really focused on and chewing through over that entire year. And 23 saw similar, where distillate was kind of in the forefront. And I think that's why, you know, if you look at some of the high returns that you've seen in it, I think that's why a lot of the natural gas guys had not large natural gas funds did really well in 22 and 23. It was kind of a combo of a little bit of everything. Where we are currently, I think this year is really fascinating. OPEC still has a ton of spare capacity, but the fundamentals right now are very strong. Obviously, everything we're seeing in the Red Sea is bullish. And realistically, if OPEC didn't have the cuts they currently have on, and we were seeing what we're seeing right now, we'd probably be around $100 oil already. But because of the headwinds and that looming effect that's still there, I think they will put a cap on it. If we rally, I'd probably say we're at right around $80 Brent oil here. I think anywhere close to 85, 90, I think you'll see Saudi talk about releasing some of the cuts that they had to try to meet it. So, you know, I do think that everything is looking pretty bullish, but the headwinds of just someone can turn the spigots on pretty quickly is going to put a cap on it. I'm not saying we can't get through there, but I just don't think it's a demand story that's going to back it to get to, the high above 100 this year. So I sadly think that we probably will be fairly kind of range bound for oil, at least in the short term. Now gasoline and distillate are still fairly interesting, but the fact that now we got past the cold, I don't see any cold on the horizon really. It actually seems like winter's kind of warming up even here. So I'm curious if distillate, if we're just not going to have the heating degree days and demand to keep it kind of going.
And
But it's good.
explain distillate real quick for those who don't
Distillate
know.
is diesel fuel and also heating oil. So it's kind of a combo that you can use to refer to both of them, and jet fuel for those three. And so what you see is, in the winter, obviously a lot of the East Coast still heats their home with heating oil. And then also is diesel demand as well. So you get a lot of demand from trucking and from kind of global macro upticks. And when you have really warm winters like this, it just allows you to build up stockpiles pretty quickly.
And so is that heavily tied in with refining?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
So what with Russia, Ukraine, and you said distillates spiked, that was
Yeah.
because the refined product wasn't coming out of there?
Exactly. And then in the last kind of couple of weeks, what we've seen is because of the cold weather that we had in the Gulf Coast and really all over the United States, I think they lost about 15% of the refining capacity in the Gulf Coast. So distillate and gasoline have been very strong over the last couple of weeks. Something that we've caught pretty well this month. I think this month we're up just a little over 2%. But it's been something that we've done very well on being long on those.
And so as oil trader, but your portfolio is more than just oil. So you trade all the distillate. So walk through all the products that you
Oil and
could
oil
have on.
products is the easiest way to think about it for us. So the two primary ones are gasoline and distillate. So we trade, WTI, Brent, gasoline, and heating oil, and kind of every combo in there. And a gasoline to kind of bring it back up, a gasoline crack and a distillate crack is the amount of money you make by refining a product. So, right now, distillate cracks are around $30, which means that if you took a barrel of oil and say for some reason you had a magic oil refinery that only made 100% distillate, you'd make $30 by putting it through there. It's kind of like your margin on refining, for lack of better words.
And what's the overall, right? I'm harking back to California. It was like, we're not allowing any new, or the California Refiners Association wrote that letter of like, it takes us 10 years and $1 billion to plan out a refinery. And you're saying you're not going to have gas cars in 10 years. Like, why would we build a new refinery and increase refining product capacity? So
California
what?
also kicks themselves in the junk even more by they have a special kind of gasoline called CARBOB, which is very expensive and difficult to make. So that's why, another reason why gasoline in California is expensive.
So what
And
is, yeah, go ahead.
go ahead.
I was just gonna say, what given us that outside of California, like the whole refining
California,
capacity, what does it
really,
look like?
in the United States, we have different PADD regions, is how we kind of break it down. I should know that acronym, and I definitely do, but it's definitely lost me at this
Escaping
point.
you, yeah.
But PADD 1 is the Northeast, PADD 2 is MidCon, mostly Chicago, PADD 3 is the Gulf Coast, and then PADD 4 is more kind of Denver area and that whole kind of space, and then PADD 5 is California. And what's unique about California is there's really no oil. It's really difficult to get oil over there. There's no pipelines that kind of flow east to west. So actually, they end up either importing a lot of their oil or their gasoline that they need from Asia. So it's kind of a unique island that PADD 5 is usually its own kind of microcosm, whereas PADDs 1, 2, and 3 really drive the oil, the product markets.
And so pad excluding pad five, what does the refining look like in the rest of it? Are we building refining capacity, or is there this overhang of like, we're not
No,
going to
I
need
think
it in
that's
50
yeah,
years,
no,
we're all going
there's
electric?
and that's where that's what everyone tracks is refineries are really complex and you have to plan these outages like months in advance. And so most of the refineries will come out and say, okay, hey, we're going to go down for 6 weeks to clean this or redo this or fix this. And there's engineers, there's people, you got to plan for, you got to reconfigure your refinery to not run in that specific unit. So what we've tracked very closely is refinery turnarounds, and we track that on a unit level basis. So we look at each refinery unit what goes into that refinery unit, and then what would come out of that. So how much
what's
gas?
A unit, like the whole refinery, or like
yeah,
what
so
they
a refinery is made up of 10 or 12 different units, and each one does a different thing, whether it's create more gasoline, whether it's kind of get to fuel oil, whether it's to blend it. They create, each
And they
one has
can't
a different.
easily switch units back and
No,
forth.
they're very complex and very large and very, but it's a flow chart. And so if one breaks, you can't just go around it. You can at time, but you
Right.
produce.
Or if, hey, jet fuel is way more profitable, let's switch over this.
Yeah. So they can do that to a certain extent. And that's exactly, there's, petroleum engineering, that's their entire job, is trying to optimize the refinery for returns. So they'll, if for some reason distillate cracks went to $60 and gasoline was 30, there's a wiggle room where you can change it a little bit and produce more distillate versus gasoline by putting in a different type of crude. So each crude, when you put into a refiner, actually produces a different kind of distribution of products. So if you took one barrel of oil out of Midland and put it in an oil refinery, you'd get XYZ. Whereas if you take one heavy sour out of Mexico and put it through an oil refinery, it'd be a very different breakdown. So there's all this breakdown, and there's entire teams dedicated to buying the right amount of oil to try to get that blend right, so you're in the sweet spot where you're kind of maximizing your profit.
And let's talk greenflation, where you stand on it, right? We're touching on a little bit here, but is this move towards electric, is this move towards everything's got to be green, more wind, more solar, more everything, short-term bullish for energies, long-term bullish for
I
oil,
think
which
it's
doesn't
very
make sense?
long-term bullish for energy, and I think what you said is a great, lead-in. That why would I build an oil refinery that takes 10 years to recover the costs when you're telling us we're not going to need oil in 10 years? And you're seeing that across the whole energy space, whether it's even oil exploration in Texas, the Gulf Coast, wherever you're seeing this, their demand, oil demand is still increasing, and it likely will increase for the next decade, just global demand, that is. Yet future investment in supply is declining. And there's going to be a point where demand passes supply on the yearly basis. And that's going to spike oil very materially higher. And it's going to be a situation where they're not going to be able to turn it on, because typically, some people always say the best cure for high prices is high
High
prices.
price, right?
Yeah. When does, at $250 oil, all of a sudden people are exploring everywhere trying to find oil. But if you still have the belief that the government is either A, going to tax it out, or B, just legislate it out where you're not allowed to drill or take it away, why would you be involved, and why would you put money to work with something that you're not sure is going to be around in 10 years? So, I think you're in the sweet spot where this year, not so much, but I think probably by next summer, I think demand will have caught up to kind of the overhang. I think OPEC will have released their supply, and I think that'll be start to be the turning point where demand will outpace the future supply growth that we've seen in the last 2 years.
And that supply growth was still all COVID hangover?
No, supply is going pretty good here in the United States. I forget, we outgrew last year pretty substantially, mostly in Midland, but some North Dakota, and kind of a little bit of all over, but the growth was still pretty strong. They're just getting more efficient, and the efficiency factors are getting really good at it. But there's a point where it's just not going to be there anymore. And even if you get more efficient, you're still not going to be able to kind of squeeze the barrel out of the ground even more without massive infrastructure investment. And at $70 oils, and the fact
Yeah.
that your recovery time is not a 10, 15 year PE project, it's now you're trying to squeeze all your returns into 5 years. On your DCF analysis, it's looking like, wow, we need XYZ $90 oil to break even, because we have to get all our money out of it in 5 years before electric vehicles take over and the demand goes kind of craters. So it's
And
it's
what are, do you know off the top of your head what those numbers look like? Like shale was is what's its cost of production like?
oh,
Right?
I think the last I saw was low 60s.
Okay.
But again, it all
Versus
depends.
Saudi's like 10 or something.
Saudi is irrelevant. Yeah,
Yeah.
five,
Yeah.
six.
Just, hey, here's some oil. Pick it up.
Yeah, that's there's oil.
And then how do you square all that with like the, as we talked about before, Saudis could just turn on the spigot whenever they want, but eventually that won't even be enough to outstrip demand, you're saying?
And also, I mean, the big thing you're thinking about with all these is is every well, if you're not either drilling more, is really declining. Like most of the decline in rates on shale is massive. Meaning, I think it was something like it produces 90% of the total oil over the first 18 months. And then it's just a steep decline curve out that, but which is why they were great, because everyone wanted to invest in them because you're getting so much
get
money.
It back right away. Yeah.
You get your money out fast, but then it decreases so fast. Now they've gotten better at kind of smoothing that and getting the long terms out there, but it's still a situation where if you want to get long-term investment into the oil space, I think it's really hard.
From a infrastructure standpoint.
From an infrastructure, from a cap raise, I mean, even at where we're at now, rates, you know, with rates where they are, getting funding for these longer term oil projects is just getting really expensive.
Yeah. And then you also have the like social pressure, right? Like if you're Harvard or some of these schools you mentioned, like, hey, we're going to take the endowment money and invest in oil exploration. People are like, what? You crazy?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do that with our school's money.
Yeah, exactly. You're seeing that a lot where the fossil fuels are kind of out, but it's a weird scenario because you're going to need it.
And right. But eventually eventually that curve switches, right?
Yeah. So eventually that curve switches where demand is below and supply, you know, demand decreases. And will we push oil lower? Yes. You know, will gasoline be cheap? Sure. And there'll be some byproducts that come out of it. But you know, you've seen that with natural gas. Like, you know, natural gas has been from $15 down to $2 to a byproduct, and then it have had its day in the sun. And you know, natural gas hedge funds are thriving, and we've basically been in a kind of a short term range for the last decade, and they've done very well. So it's really a unique scenario.
But do you think like 50 years out, whatever that number is, some long term out, right? And everyone's wildest dreams come true, and we're solar and wind and everything, and all electric vehicles. And
what
happens to oil? But there's still oil in the ground.
Still going to need oil. You're still going to need it. It's one of, you know, plastics, chemicals. You know, there's still a lot of things that come out of an oil refinery that are needed. Now, will gasoline be a byproduct? Maybe. And maybe they'll find a way to kind of use the ones that they need and get rid of the other ones. But if there's one thing I know, I mean, if you look at a lithium mine and then you look at another refinery, which one looks worse for the environment?
Yeah.
you look at our power grid, and you can do it on, it'll take anyone 10 seconds to Google it and figure out how much grid electricity we would need to, you know, actually power every car and get it going. And it's the grid, just infrastructure just isn't there. Now, 20 years from now, maybe with the amount of investment that they could do, but it's just not there. And that's where I just don't see, you know, globally it becoming an issue where it's going to be something along those lines.
Right. And it's not for your 10-year plan personally and for Kaler Capital, like there's still a trade here for at least 10, 20, 30 years.
And even then, I think it's a situation where, you know, I think if, say, we get to that point 20 years from now, I still think oil is going to be interesting. It's just a function of what product will we be trading. Would it be something where maybe we add plastics in the mix and now we're trading plastics because it's the sexy part of the only part that they want? Propane, you know, there's all these different kind of aspects that you can be a part of and get out. So, I mean, we're trading a very small sliver of the oil barrel, and we could expand that pretty substantially if we needed to or wanted to.
You could shift to electricity, really go crazy.
Always power trades.
Yes. All right. What else you got on that regard? Anything?
No, I think we solved the world.
We solved the world's problems, right? Yeah. Hey, we're going to need the oil. We're going to need plastic.
I do think this is a very interesting year because of the headwind of OPEC and also the fact that it's an election year. The last thing the Biden administration wants is Donald Trump getting on a podium and harping on him about $7 gasoline. So they're going to do everything in their power to try to keep this under wraps in the Red Sea. So, I mean, I'm a long-term bull, but I'm kind of short-term agnostic, I'd say.
And what we were speaking of Biden, all the SPR release, all that mumbo jumbo, was that politics? Was that needed?
It's always politics. Everything about the SPR is politics. There's, you know,
have they refilled it? What's the status of it?
I think they started to. Yeah, I think they're still in the process of doing it.
It seems like you could trade around that, no? Like they kind of telegraph it, then they say where they want to buy it, but they probably don't.
It doesn't move the needle substantially on the global oil, you know, landmark, you know, overall on it. So, you know, when he did it the first time, it did a little bit, but in the long run, it doesn't have much effect.
And then Russia, Ukraine is still going on, which
still going on, but every
we, a lot of us forget. But I guess, are you saying it was a non-event? Like the oil kept coming out?
Yeah, China and India are basically buying almost 100% of Russian oil, and they basically said we don't care, and they get it for cheap, and it's boosting their economies, and they're seeing, hey, we get oil at a 40% discount or 30%, whatever it is that they're buying it at. So they just don't care. And you know, Iran's out here doing their stuff in the Red Sea, and yes, we have sanctions on them, but they're still producing almost their max oil. So the sanctions aren't really helping either. And again, that's something where, you know, India and China are just saying, yeah, we'll buy it. It's good. Send it over.
Yeah. And what does that look like? Like there's the sanctions and those are members of UN supposedly, but there's ways they skirt it all.
Yeah. I'm not sure the logistics of it, but I think just kind of basically say, no, we're not going to.
No, we're buying it from Glencore. It's all good.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm sorry to miss you down in Miami, but we saw you in Wyoming. But yes, have fun and good luck on the panel. You'll do great.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate
all right.
It. Okay, that's it for the pod. Thanks to Brent. Thanks to RCM for their support. Thanks to Jeff Berger for producing. We'll be back next week talking logistics with the CEO of trucking company Roadrunner. So go ahead and subscribe so you get it right when it drops. Peace.
You've been listening to The Derivative. Links from this episode will be in the episode description of this channel. Follow us on Twitter at RCMAlts and visit our website to read our blog or subscribe to our newsletter at RCMAlts.com. If you liked our show, introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe. And be sure to leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of RCM Alternatives, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations nor reference past or potential profits, and listeners are reminded that managed futures, commodity trading, and other alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.